Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sports Grid Fantasy Football Podcast. My name is Davis Maddock. Today, I am joined on the show by Matt Friedman. I was listening to him and Dave Caban on RotoViz Radio, which you guys should all be listening to. And first off, I have to say, I have never heard a more Friedman thing ever than that you drink multiple cups of coffee a day, but you have not drinking regular caffeinated coffee in 7 years, that you just pound decaf coffee all day. That is like extremely, extremely Friedman.
Yeah, it is. I mean, pound is a little too strong of a verb, but certainly multiple cups per day, multiple cups in the morning. And I'd say multiple cups in the afternoon going into evening. And it's just like a force of habit at this point. It's not as if I really like need it for any particular reason. It's just, it's, you know, something that's been happening for years. So I'm just, you know, it's an acquired taste at this point. So yeah, it continues.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of go back for that afternoon cup of coffee, even if I'm not feeling tired, right? Even if I, you know, it's been a good day, I'm hydrated, I got 8 hours of sleep. Like, I do just kind of go back to that 2-3 PM cup of coffee, just totally out of habit, basically.
Yeah.
So I get it. It is. Yeah. It is funny though.
No, it's ridiculous.
So we. And the idea though also of you having to quit cold turkey, like the fine espresso club that father-in-law was sending you because you had an espresso machine and you were getting like, you know, the finest Brazilian hand-picked beans. Like, it's just that again. Oh, yeah. I mean, that was a Seinfeld episode. Like, that was like Kramer and Jerry get addicted to fine espresso. Like, it was just incredible.
It really was. It was like a quadruple shots every hour of Colombian and Guatemalan, Ethiopian. Like, it was just, it was too much. It was the best and the worst.
Speaking of the best and the worst, we gotta try and figure out this Washington backfield, right? And there are a couple reasons why this is true. First off, the worst fantasy analysis in the world is, well, we don't know who's going to win this backfield, so you should just avoid it, because basically all of the research that's been done on fantasy football and finding running back breakouts, it basically says, you know, where you find these league-winning running backs, it's not from drafting Tony Pollard. It's not from drafting Alexander Mattison, you know, the guys who get there with an injury. It's guys who actually break out, right? So it's guys who come from the four – it's the Darren Sproles, the Danny Woodhead, like the guys were like, yeah, you're good, you see a role, and then they just end up getting 100 more touches than you anticipate. So first off, let's start there with the idea that we actually should be targeting these muddy backfields.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like one of the pieces that got early hate for me at RotoViz was when I was saying that people should draft multiple running backs in the same muddy backfield. And I believe it was the St. Louis Rams at the time. But, I mean, it's the same idea here. You could probably do a lot worse than just blindly drafting Antonio Gibson and Adrian Peterson and then, like, Bryce Love with your last pick or something like that. There's a decent chance that one of those guys hits.
Yeah. So, I think as far as Washington goes, I actually do think that if I were – well, okay – what do you handicap the odds that Adrian Peterson leads the team in carries at the end of the year? You know, assuming 16-game season, you know, no significant pandemic interference. What do you handicap those odds at?
55-60%. Like, I have,
so like plus 135-ish.
Yeah, something like that. Like, I have him projected right now to lead the team in carries. Even though I assume that by the end of the season, I don't assume, but project, I imagine that by the end of the season, Antonio Gibson on a per game basis for like the last month or 2 months is the guy who actually leads the backfield and carries.
So I have Adrian Peterson projected for 159 carries, probably too many rushing yards. I probably need to, I'm just looking that I have him at too high of a yards per carry. So I probably need to go in and tone that down. But 159 carries for him. Let's see what I have for Bryce Love. I have Bryce Love for 28 carries. And he's the guy who, by the way, I actually think Bryce Love is way more of a mystery than Antonio Gibson. If Gibson is good, like if he gets into training camp, he gets into week one, you know, he's picking up pass blocks, he's not fumbling, I anticipate that they are just going to use him as – what's like a good NFL – because I don't think he is – maybe kind of Sproulsy, maybe kind of Woodheady, but targeted a little bit further down the field. Actually, you know what a great comp for him is? What Boston Scott did for the Eagles last year. So while Miles Sanders was like the primary back and still getting targeted, Boston Scott was playing in the slot. He was getting some red zone carries. I think that's a pretty decent comp. But Bryce Love, you could tell me that they cut him in favor of keeping Peyton Barber on the roster, or that he leads them with 210 rushes, and I think I would believe either thing.
Yeah, who knows? Incredibly wide range of outcomes. And I have a similar rushing projection, although I feel I need to bump him up a little bit, but I have 23 carries for Bryce Love this year, 183 carries for Adrian Peterson.
I think that sounds right about right. And then, you know, this is again also to say, like, I mean, Ron Rivera could fall in love with JD McKissic or Peyton Barber, or Antonio Gibson could just be a rookie who's barely played the running back position before, and he could be 65 PPR points at the end of year one. And or again, and this is people, I've seen people point this out as a positive, and I can't really decide if it is or not. They might be so thin at wide receiver that as a rookie, it makes most sense for him to play wide receiver as opposed to running back. You know, they have this running back room with Adrian Peterson. They have Peyton Barber. They have JD McKissic. You can say whatever you want about how unskilled or skilled those two players are. They are NFL players, you know, like they know how to pass block. They know how to do their jobs. And Antonio Gibson may or may not know how to do that at this point. And Gibson might be like, I mean, Gibson might just do what Trey Quinn did last year, which would be a bummer.
Right. Like they could look at him and say, legitimately, this guy is already the best slot receiver on our team, and decide that the best three wide receiver set makes sense with McLaurin on the outside, Antonio Gandy Golden on the outside, and then Gibson in the slot.
You could say that the camp battle, instead of it being Adrian Peterson versus Antonio Gibson, it might be Gibson versus Gandy Golden in terms of that playing time, because they could play Cam Sims or Darvin Kidzie or whoever, you know. That being said, I am hype. I'm going to be hyper aggressive in drafting Gibson because it's also one of those things where, like, I've been doing drafts since March, you know, and have you played on Drafters at all? There was just this very weird quirk where he was, because he came in late, he was just listed very low in their draft software. Like, he was like in their draft software, his name came after like Josh Kelly and Deion Lewis and stuff. So like, to draft him, you actually had to scroll all the way down, or you had to actually search for his name. So in the Drafters Championship, which is, you know, it's not as big as Underdog or DraftKings or anything, but you could get him with like your 17th round selection. So he's my most owned player in their best ball championship, just because him and Chenault, you could just take them every single time and there was no penalty. Whereas on DraftKings now, the Underdog leagues are the sharpest, but the DraftKings leagues are getting a little bit sharper, but you can still, unless you're in your draft with a zealot, you can still get him in like the 10th, 11th or 12th round.
Yeah, that's great value. I mean, I agree. I think it makes sense to be aggressive with him. And, you know, I see some people on Twitter saying that, they should be cautious. And I understand the negative side, like the bear case on Antonio Gibson. But I don't know. I think it makes sense to skew the other way, because he certainly does have league winning potential. And that's what you're going for. And at this point in August, there aren't all that many players who really do have clear league winning potential at their ADP if they hit their upside. So Gibson is, I think, someone certainly to target.
So I think one of the hesitations that people are going to have would be, well, he didn't really play running back, right?
Like, that's correct.
He played. So he did carry the ball. He was being used in a backfield with, like, actually in a weird way, other NFL running back prospects, right? Yeah. So like he was actually on a team with Tony Pollard, which is funny because when you go look at his RotoViz box score scout, who do you think shows up as his top sim score? It is Tony Pollard. Now the weird thing, because he is in the sim score as a running back and not a wide receiver, So a lot of the times in these sim scores, you'll see guys with a similarity score of 90, 85, you know, 75, and those are pretty good comps. The closest comp to him is Tony Pollard with a sim score of 63, and then there is no one even close to him until 39, right, which is CJ ProSize. So I think this highlights that, like, the prototype of someone like Gibson becoming a running back in the NFL, which I think is probably because he's not fast enough to be a wide receiver at the NFL level. You know, like, well, I guess he was sort of fast, but like,
Gibson?
Yeah.
No, Gibson's super fast. 4.39.
Okay, well then why
is Jonathan Taylor size in athleticism, like a doppelganger at the combine for Jonathan Taylor.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't realize. I thought he was closer to like a 4 or 5. So do you know anything specifically about why Gibson wants to play running back as opposed to wide receiver in the NFL?
I think it's that they look at him and they think this dude's a running back. You know, like they think it's very David Johnson-esque where, you know, he in high school was a wide receiver, but they moved him to running back thinking, okay, this guy has great size, great athleticism. He could be a really strong receiver out of the backfield, and he'll probably be good enough as a runner to where we can still use him as a running back. I think it's a really similar thesis with Antonio Gibson. He played running back in high school. He still saw some carries in junior college, which, by the way, in junior college, and who knows how you know much weight you want to give the statistics, but he did lead his team in receiving as a freshman and sophomore in junior college. Didn't do anything as a junior at Memphis, but that's because he was playing behind Tony Pollard and Daryl Henderson. His senior season, whenever he actually got a chance to do something, he played the Tony Pollard role, and he played it better than Tony Pollard. You know, he did line up in the backfield and did take some carries as a running back, but most of his carries were jet sweeps, and all of his carries, literally not one of his carries, was up the middle. All of his carries were off tackle. So, yeah, there are legitimate questions of can this guy be an actual NFL running back? Can he run up the middle? But, I mean, people had questions, those same questions about David Johnson when he was entering the league.
I mean, people had those questions about Alvin Kamara.
Yeah, can he run up the middle? And the answer is it doesn't fucking matter. Sorry, I don't even know if I can say that word on your show.
You can. But you're allowed.
It doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter if he can run up the middle.
What NFL teams are even doing that? Like, think about watching an NFL game. How many teams are calling runs up the middle?
Yeah, just imagine thinking that a guy who literally is the Jonathan Taylor doppelganger and athleticism, who was as productive as this guy was in college, who is at worst a strongly above average receiving option as a running back, that guy can't succeed, especially when he was drafted with a really high third round pick and there's no one in front of him on the depth chart except for, you know, Adrian Peterson, but, you know, like, who has a legitimate path to playing time. I can't imagine not being optimistic about that guy.
So we should talk about Bryce Love a little bit and basically what happened to him. So in 2017 at Stanford, Bryce Love was a true junior. He recorded 263 carries. No one else on the team had more than 91. He recorded 2,100 rushing yards. Now, only caught 6 passes. That's like a giant red flag in terms of being a prospect. But, you know, then again, at Stanford, they just don't throw all that often. Like comparatively, Christian McCaffrey, his final season, I mean, you'd be like, Christian McCaffrey, oh, he probably caught 100 passes, right, his final year at Stanford, or at least like 60. Christian McCaffrey, his final year, 253 rushing attempts, 37 receptions. So it's like, yes, 6 receptions, that's pretty bad, right? But also, this is a team that, like, literally wants to throw the ball 350 times a year. Like, they're just not – they would so much rather hand the ball off to Bryce Love than throw it to him. So I'm not gonna penalize him that much. But he actually, in a weird way, kind of falls in that same bucket as Darius Geis, which is, like, he literally has not been healthy in, like, 3 seasons.
Yes, that really is the problem. It's so unfortunate he didn't enter the NFL after 2017, which was a fantastic year in terms of just running the ball, like all-time great type of season as a runner. but just wanted to go back to college. He would have been a 21-year-old rookie, you know, probably drafted in the second round if he exited in 2017, and then tore his ACL, I believe, literally on his final college carry in 2018. And so, you know, that just automatically submarined his draft stock, you know, because he's smaller. He doesn't have verified athleticism, and he looks like a guy who can't catch the ball. Why would someone spend a high draft pick on him? You know, and then, yeah, he didn't play at all last year, so we really don't know what to expect out of him this year.
And, I mean, a lot of why people are wrapped up in thinking he is a sleeper does come from that 2017 season where he was a Heisman Trophy candidate, which, like, you know, kind of at the end of the day, you want it to matter a ton, but draft position ends up being so much of a better predictor than even like college success.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not as if like he had a Marcus Lattimore level of injury, but it's like Marcus Lattimore was a great college player too. And it ended up not mattering at all. You know, like I'm pretty pessimistic about Bryce Love.
Yeah. So I think all of those reasons are why we are in on Antonio Gibson, you know, why we're just going to keep, we're going to keep smashing that, that draft button. But
I want to ask a quick question here, Davis. Do you think because Gibson played the Tony Pollard role in college, I mean, literally the Tony Pollard role, do you think that it is fair for us to assume that that is transferable to the NFL and that he has Tony Pollard-esque type of potential?
Well, Tony Pollard's hype, you know, everyone was so excited about him last year because of the Ezekiel Elliott holdout. Now we're seeing a similar thing with Gibson where, you know, his obstacle to starting was removed. And when Pollard played in both the preseason and the regular season, I think he answered a lot of the questions on, you know, can you play running back at the NFL level? Can you pass block? Does your team trust you to be in there? And Pollard didn't play a ton in high leverage, but, you know, he had that game against the Dolphins. And basically he looked good whenever he got on the field. So now we all universally agree Tony Pollard can play running back in the NFL, right? We don't have any concerns that if Elliott goes down, they're going to be giving carries to Jordan Chun or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think with Gibson, it's a little bit of, I actually would not buy in Dynasty now at this price, right? Because I'm not as much of a true believer in him as I was for Pollard. Like I thought what we saw with Pollard was, you know, like a player who could play kind of in any position and would end up mattering for fantasy at some point. And also, it is worth noting for Dynasty purposes, Pollard is in the, I mean, he's got a 25-year-old quarterback who looks like he's one of the five best quarterbacks. They're going to score, you know, 28 points a game for the next decade. You know, who knows what happens with Ron Rivera and Dwayne Haskins and that whole circus, you know, as far as Dynasty goes. But yeah, so I think that even as like a projection, Gibson probably projects a little bit worse than Pollard, just even if he gets there, you know, if both of them get there just because of the situation. And, you know, I could certainly see a scenario where Pollard works out in the NFL. Turns out Gibson is not that quality of player, and it doesn't end up working out.
That's fair. That could happen. It just, it seems weird to me because the projection on Pollard is based on a really small sample of what he's done in the NFL. And it, like, it's something, it's all we have. But I mean, I feel like if you are enthusiastic about Pollard, you should probably be enthusiastic about Gibson, minus the fact that Pollard's with the Cowboys and Gibson isn't, right? That, and that's not insignificant, but I feel like there are a lot of other things that tie them together and suggest that Gibson could be Pollard-esque or even better.
Yeah. All right. So let's look at Gibson last 4 days in the Football Guys Players Championship on FFPC and compare him to some of the guys that he is now going over. So over the last 4 days in the Football Guys Players Championship, have you looked at this, by the way? Do you know?
No.
Okay. So where do you guess that he is going?
I would guess that at a floor, he's going roughly where Darius Geis was. And I would say probably even higher. So I would say like maybe, I don't know, like running back 28.
So he is going as the last 4 days. So Geis was released on Friday or Saturday?
Yes, Friday.
So, okay. So this actually probably is including a couple, or at least, you know, a couple drafts from Thursday night then where, you know, Geis was still being drafted. So Antonio Gibson is going as the running back 36, 92nd overall. He is being selected over Zach Moss. Yeah. Okay. So this is including including seven drafts where Darius Geis was still selected. So the real answer, Antonio, the earliest he has gone is the 6-11 with the 71st pick.
Yeah.
So
that's, that's more realistic.
Yeah. When Peter and Pat and I, we did a Football Guys Players Championship team last Wednesday, and we got Antonio Gibson in the 12th round. So crown us the champions right now, right? That's
some sweet honey.
So this is really interesting because the market has now decided that Gibson is better than Moss. Gibson is better than Tony Pollard. Gibson is better than Boston Scott, Daryl Henderson. I got to say, the market might have priced me out. The market might have just priced me out of Antonio Gibson. Like, if he is going to go three rounds ahead of DeAndre Washington, I think I probably just have to say I've already gotten my exposure, and that's going to be that.
I think that's fair, but he should be going three rounds ahead of DeAndre Washington. You know, like that's he should be. People should be super aggressive on him.
People should be aggressive on him. But this gets into the territory of like, well, when do you and Dave Caban do your main event draft? Usually.
About a week before the season starts.
So
pretty late.
So I've done them both early, right? I've done one really early, right when the main event first starts. I think I did one last year on like August 4th or 5th or something. And then I did one the night before, or actually after the season had already started with the Thursday games in there. And the Antonio Gibson ADP to me seems like when you are drafting, literally like the last main event draft that happens where Justice Hill's going in the 7th round, Darwin Thompson's going in the 7th round, like any zero RB guy you want, you basically have to draft him as a starter for your team because there is no juice left in that orange to squeeze.
Yeah. I mean, I would rather have Gibson over Zach Moss. Like easily, I would rather have him over Zach Moss.
So I don't like Zach Moss at all, right? But Crane has basically been in my ear for the last 2 months telling me not only how Zach Moss was a good like dynasty buy, but is now a good redraft buy, you know, kind of thinking that the gap in ADP between Singletary and Moss is way too high.
Yeah, I don't have anything against Moss. He's actually, I think, a really good zero RB buy in that we know he's probably going to have a locked-in role, just like with a minimum touch floor, especially as a runner. But there's a chance he actually ends up being the main receiving back. Singletary hasn't been great as a receiver. Moss might really be better. And Moss has a good shot at the goal line carries. So, like, he has his own role anyway, which has some pretty significant value with it. And then, of course, if Singletary gets injured, Moss, I mean, he just looks like a league winner. So there's a lot to like about Moss, but he doesn't have that clear path the way that Gibson does, you know? So I prefer Gibson.
Yeah. I mean, I think preferring Gibson is fine. So one of the reasons, I guess, why I might not be priced out is have you had this feeling in drafts where after the 6th round is done, it feels the same to you basically for the rest of the draft. So for me, the canary in the coal mine is once Will Fuller goes and once Ronald Jones goes. So those two guys, Ronald Jones goes off the board, Will Fuller goes off the board, and then we get – so literally, and this is true, it's actually very crazy this year how different ADP is on the different formats, but this rule is universally true. Once Will Fuller goes and once Ronald Jones goes, then you get into J.K. Dobbins, A.J. Green, Tyler Boyd will be in there, and Michael Gallup now goes ahead of Will Fuller because the market is starting to realize, you know, how good Gallup is going to be this year. But for me, basically, so then you get into Jarvis Landry, Julian Edelman, James White, Marlon Mack. Like, I essentially think that after kind of pick 70 or 75 or so, I don't even know if there are reaches, right? Because these guys all project so insanely flat to me, basically. Right. Like, I'm just like, if you want to take Christian Kirk with your seventh round pick, take him. If you want to take Jordan Howard or Tevin Coleman with your eighth round pick, take them, because I don't even think that you are making massive opportunity cost sacrifices at that point. And it's also why I found myself taking Dak and Kyler and Deshaun Watson so often this year, because would I rather have Dak Prescott on my fantasy football team or Julian Edelman? Would I rather have Deshaun Watson or AJ Green? I would so much rather have Deshaun Watson.
Okay. So I agree with you 100% on the Ronald Jones cutoff, because to me that really is the hard cutoff. We're after him
at running back.
At running back, yeah. Because after him, it feels like, okay, you're just, all of the guys are pretty similar. You just kind of shoot your shot on the guys that you prefer the most after Ronald Jones. And I'm in on him pretty aggressively. And so for me, it's even more of a pretty hard cutoff, because he's someone I'm explicitly targeting, where if I don't get him, it feels like I really lost on something. At wide receiver, I get your point on Fuller, but there are some guys going after him that I still really do prefer. And so for me, it feels like those guys are a little bit more of the cutoff. So for instance, like, maybe I'm just totally wrong, but like DeSean Jackson, I think he's pretty significantly undervalued. And so like there are other guys going after Fuller where I feel like I still prefer them pretty strongly to a lot of the other guys who would be left on the board if those guys go.
So I've seen your DeSean Jackson propaganda. And I mean, really the only rebuttal I have to this is he has not played a full season since 2016.
Right.
And like the sort of injuries that he is now mounting up are the kind where I'm like, this guy at this point is like the Black Knight, right? Where it's just like, how can I reasonably expect him to play 16 games? Because nothing is worse for your best ball rosters than injuries, right? Right. Yeah. Because I mean, you would rather have 16 games of Adrian Peterson churning out 16 carries for 80 yards and like scoring 4 touchdowns all year than you would just like piling up zeros. Like zeros are the enemy of best ball rosters.
Right. No, that's fair. I mean, I'm not thinking 16 games of DeSean Jackson. I'm thinking, what if we get 13 games? Because like, I think that is roughly the median outcome. What happens if we get 13 games of DeSean Jackson? I think that's pretty good. I think he would have a pretty decent chance of leading that team in air yards if he has 13 games.
If Rager is further along in his development than his critics think, like if the Rager truthers are correct that his poor performance his final season at TCU was basically just because he was stuck with, you know, a guy who ended up leaving the program, a true freshman, and, you know, a head coach who didn't know what to do with his skill sets, Rager will lead them in air yards for sure. Because Rager profiles as, if you didn't look at the raw numbers and you only looked at his, you know, breakout age, market share, and everything, like, Rager would be such a stud.
Yeah. I mean, Rager, I love his long-term potential, and he certainly does have potential this year, but I think a lot of that is tied to the idea that Alshon Jeffery is out and DeSean Jackson is out for a significant chunk of the season. Rager, even though there are excuses that can certainly be made for him, the fact is he really did fail to develop last year because of the circumstances around him. You know, like they didn't move him around the formation. He was stuck pretty much only on one side. I think it actually does still hurt him that he didn't have a quarterback who was good at throwing to him because he didn't develop the way he should have. So I think I like Rager long term, but I think it will be a little bit slower of a burn for him.
So in terms of rookie wide receivers, I've been pretty aggressive drafting them this year. You know, like I only take Lamb when I take Dak because I think that their ceilings are pretty tied together. But like I like Lamb.
Yeah.
I only take Ayuk when I take Jimmy G. But Rager, I like him probably a little bit less than the market because Ruggs and. Yes. I mean, Laviska Shenault. Well, I actually don't even know your opinion on Laviska Shenault, but Shenault is, I think, probably my most drafted player. What's the Oracle take on Shenault?
Shenault is a stud. He's especially thinking of rookie drafts, he provides so much value because he can very routinely be acquired in the second round, middle second round, even sometimes later in the second round. And I mean, he's up there, not in terms of the touchdowns that he scores because he was in a really bad offense, but in terms of the yards that he gets on a per route basis, he was up there with the best guys in the class, and he was dominant against man coverage just because he's so physical, like much more dominant against man than your typical college wide receiver is. And that doesn't take into account at all the fact that he could be used legitimately in a Cordarrelle Patterson-esque type of way as a runner.
Just when I think about it, I get the goosebumps.
It's unreal. So, I mean, look at this. Chenault, in his two seasons, his two main seasons as a contributor there, he had 62% success rate against man. CeeDee Lamb had 58% success rate. Jerry Jeudy had a 53% success rate. Like, there are legitimate reasons to be excited about Chenault on a per route basis, 3.5 yards per route. That's the same as CeeDee Lamb, 3.5, and Jerry Jeudy had 3.4. Like, Chenault is up there with those dudes, and he's big and he's fast. Like, people will kind of poo-poo what he did at the combine when he was injured, but even if you take those numbers as his legitimate
injured numbers, his top comp in the RotoViz box score scout is Mike Thomas.
I know. Even if you take the injured numbers, okay, what he basically has is Davante Adams' speed plus 15 pounds of muscle. Like, the dude is going to ball out. It might not happen immediately in year one.
But I think it could, though, because if he's good, he's better than Chris Conley, and the team is over D.D. Westbrook. Like, they tried D.D. Westbrook, and it didn't work out.
Right.
So there's – and they don't – I mean, Tyler Eifert, like, they don't have a tight end. And so there's just so – there are so many targets there if he's good. Like, some rookie wide receivers are good, but they have to wait for the targets. There's nothing stopping Chenault from getting targeted.
It really – you're right. It could be an Anquan Boldin-esque type of onslaught from the very beginning if Chenault is good.
Yeah, so I'm pretty in on Chenault, and that's one where the market seems to not really be caught up relative to what fantasy football Twitter thinks, right?
Yes,
where like everyone on fantasy Twitter will tell you they love Chenault, but the last 4 days in the Football Guys Players Championship, he goes as the wide receiver 69, 197th overall, after Jalen Hurd, after Randall Cobb, like. I mean, what are you doing taking Randall Cobb ahead of LaVisca Chenault? No. Like, what are you hoping to have happen there?
And looking at this now, thinking of it, if I have made a mistake in drafts this year, like a mistake of not drafting someone enough versus a mistake of like Ronald Jones, of being too levered to Ronald Jones, the mistake is not drafting enough LaVisca Chenault. Like, that, I think that might be a mistake. And the thing is, I do think of myself as being high on Chenault, but looking at it, I don't have enough of him.
You got to be in. You got to be in on Chenault. So you got excited when I just mentioned Ruggs right there. I am so of two minds about Ruggs, where I'm like, this guy, he just really grades out as like a C+ prospect. But you think about, well, what is really change, like, what can really change games in the NFL right now? And you're like, oh yeah, when someone with 4.25 speed gets the ball and there's not a defender on their back that second, they can just go and score. And Ruggs did it all. Like, basically all of Ruggs' touchdowns at Alabama were of that variety. You know, they weren't giving him goal line screens and letting him get 3-yard touchdowns like Chenault. Like, he just was creating it all himself. And a problem is I don't necessarily see the stylistic fit with Carr.
Yeah, that's fair. I try not to think too much about fit because I feel like, one, I'm probably not best at evaluating that anyway. And then two, I feel like people might overvalue it. And then three, you know, like, fit can kind of change one way or another. Like, maybe Carr actually just ends up being better at throwing it deep than we think. Maybe Ruggs doesn't actually have to go deep all that often. Maybe it's just more kind of slant routes, and Carr could be good enough at that.
Yeah, like, but DJ Moore.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, among draft-eligible wide receivers last year, Ruggs trailed only Lamb with 13.6 yards per target. He was really efficient at turning opportunities into yards and into touchdowns. And the big thing that is held against him is that he really just didn't have a lot of volume. And I think it's a little more excusable when you look at the guys he was playing with and you're like, hey, he was sharing touches with Judy. He was sharing touches with Devontae Smith. Like, they have other guys in that that wide receiver room in Alabama who could also probably be first rounders eventually. And they didn't need to throw the ball all that often to dominate. So I think there are legitimate reasons to excuse Ruggs's lack of volume, especially when you take into account his draft stock, his athletic abilities, and the fact that on a per touch basis or per route basis, even, he was still pretty efficient.
And it's not as if there is a significant barrier to him getting a bunch of targets. Cause I'm fading Waller hard, and which is, it seems crazy to me. He's the tight end five, but I guess this is what happens every year with tight end, where after the truly elite guys, the tight ends five through nine, like, can you remember a season where like the tight end six ended up beating ADP? Like, it's a guy who's overdrafted every single year. It doesn't matter who it is. It's just like the mid round tight end is always bad.
Right.
So Waller, obviously, he's got these, even though it was only three games he played without Renfrow on the field, they were his best three games, right? So he sees this 20% decrease in targets. He sees a decrease in snaps. They sign Jason Witten. They draft Henry Ruggs. They draft Lynn Bowden Jr. They draft Bryan Edwards. And obviously Hunter Renfrow is going to be, you know, the week one starter there. So it's like, and by the way, Gruden is doing all this talking on how, okay, well, it, you know, it's a travesty that Josh Jacobs didn't win Rookie of the Year. I want to give Josh Jacobs targets this year. I'll believe it when I see it. But there are so many external pressures on Waller even seeing 100 targets this year that I can't take him where he goes.
Yeah, there's a lot of competition for targets. And that is also like one thing that gives me a little bit of pause about Ruggs. Like, I think he will be the number one wide receiver on that team, but maybe he still won't get a ton of targets, as many targets as you would expect a team's number one wide receiver to get. But what does give me a little more enthusiasm specifically about his situation is that they've talked about their desire to start him in the slot. And if they are thinking of him as someone as like a movable chess piece, someone they want to move around within that offense, giving him really nice matchups against the number three cornerback, the ability to stretch a defense down the seam. Like, I think it indicates that they really want to feature him, which could lead to more targets than I'm expecting.
For who?
For Ruggs.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's what I took from what I took away from the report that he's going to start in the slot was not like, oh, you can't take Hunter Renfrow in the 18th round anymore. It was, if Ruggs is good, which is the caveat I use with all these rookies, because I don't actually think the coaches will know until like week three if any of these rookies can play or not, because there's no preseason. Our Laird was telling Peter and I that like this is the easiest training camp of his life. Like, they're basically just jogging around and kind of like having a laugh. Like, it is not real training camp at all. So I think that these rookies, the coaches are going to want to use them, but they're just not going to know how talented they are or they aren't until they get to see some game action. And by the way, football week one and week two, I mean, it's going to be bad. Like, teams with new quarterbacks, teams with, you know, backup offensive linemen, it would not surprise me if we see multiple shutouts in week one and week two, where like teams just can't get it together. Like, the offenses are just going to look terrible.
So Raymond has a theory about this, and
that the defenses will be behind.
Yeah. And so he's thinking more overs, and he's thinking, you know, those speedy wide receivers who might have the ability to exploit miscommunications in the secondary. And I mean, I could buy that, like, but I think it's going to be one thing or the other. I don't think it's going to feel like, oh, this is just a normal week one of football. It's like, no, this is going to feel like something very different.
So, you know what? This is a fun little experiment. Let's go back to 2011 in the NFL, which is the season that everyone points to as like, you know, this was the crazy year, right? Where, you know, Cam Newton had that insane rookie season.
Right.
So let's see. Did anyone get shut out in week one? No one got shut out in week one. Green Bay scored 42 points. Drew Brees threw for 419 yards against the Packers. The Eagles scored 31. The Ravens scored 35. The Texans under Matt Schaub scored 34. The Buffalo Bills with Ryan Fitzpatrick and Fred Jackson scored 41 points. The Bears scored 30. I'm guessing that would have been in the Jay Cutler era, but I can't even really remember. So it seems like more often than not in this week one, which is the most comparable week one we have, where there was a labor dispute shortened off season, the week one, the offenses were ahead of the defenses. And then we know that was true over the course of the year. You know, Eli Manning and Matt Stafford had 5,000 yard seasons that year.
Yeah, if we even look just at the games that took place in September, the over was 28-19-1 in 2011.
Yeah, so I had Ray GQ from Destination Devi on the show last week, and he was a defensive back in college, and he has echoed that same sentiment of being like, it's very hard as a defense, especially if you were on, you know, new defensive coordinator, new teammates, to like know where all of your assignments are, to be ready every snap. So I've seen a lot of people make this point. You know, this is by no means this is not an original point, but teams with the most amount of continuity, I think, are going to be at the biggest advantage.
Yeah, that's what I would expect. Man, and this, I'm looking at it now, it's even more extreme if we are looking at what teams did. Of what teams did just in weeks one and two. I mean, the overs just smashed in weeks one and two. I mean, not to say that that's what's going to happen again, but comparisons, it's 22-9-1 to the over.
Do you remember week one of the XFL where all of the unders hit?
Yeah.
So I kind of think maybe we're in a scenario like that where, like, it's going to be 80% one way or the other, where all the overs hit. I it's very hard for me to think that these opening games are going to be perfectly handicapped.
I feel like the way to maybe approach this from the sports betting perspective would be to take, like, to look at the alternative totals and to, like, bet on the big, kind of do it the straddle, where you're either betting on something where it's a big over or a really big under, where you get significant plus money on both of them.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't even know who Kansas City plays week one, but like you bet the over plus a touchdown. So what the total for that is probably what, like 56?
Yeah, that total is going to be high. Thursday night football opening game of the season, Texans, Chiefs.
Yeah, so you bet the alt line, you know, +7 on whatever the total is plus 500 or whatever.
Right.
And yeah, or bet the over on the Chiefs team total by a touchdown, like basically, or the Texans, right? Just saying either team scores an extra touchdown. I like that as a betting angle a lot.
Yeah, that line is 54.5. So I think you look for the alternative total.
Yeah,
so way over or way under in some regards, but I would lean towards the over there.
Here, let's see if this is posted on the FanDuel Sportsbook yet. 2020 season, week one, Texans Chiefs, more wagers. Okay, no, nothing. No, like super alt lines are up yet.
Yeah.
Right now you can bet the, it's only you can bet the Chiefs winning by 14 or more, but it's not good enough odds to do. It's kind of priced in because the Chiefs are favored by so much, which they should be because they're going to score so many points. All right, Matt, as we get into serious draft season, right? We all got our main events coming up. We're all hammering out the Football Guys Players Championship. We're all in these best ball drafts where there's so much money in fantasy football now. Like it's crazy. It's like I kind of get done drafting every single year and I'm like, wow, I have so much more money out than I truly feel comfortable with, but you don't realize it because you kind of nickel and dime it along the way, you know? Yeah. Who are the league winners this year? Who are Matt Friedman's league winners?
Oh boy, this is painful because I feel like I'm going to be wrong. Two running backs I am inordinately high on, in addition to Ronald Jones. James Conner feels just like a total smash to me, and I really like to try to just stack him with as many Steelers as possible. So if I can get Juju, and then I can get Conner, and then if I can go with Roethlisberger and run it back with Ebron, oh man, I'm happy. So Conner is one running back I am really in on, and then another one is Cam Akers.
Yeah, he's the dead zone running back that I like, and Ed Akers is the other dead zone guy I really like.
So I'm fully in on those two. It's not as if I'm expecting them both to be top 12 running backs, but I feel that if I get Connor and I get Akers and I get Ronald Jones, I have a pretty good chance of at least two of those guys to finish as top 12 running backs.
Yeah, Akers, by the way. So first of all, people are taking the Sean McVay quote and running with it. And again, we talked about this last time you're on the show. What do you want him to say? Right. But also, both Akers and Henderson can be buys at their ADP on the theorem of, you know, just target uncertain backfields. The Rams are going to be better. And the Rams were not even bad last year, right? We talked about that the last time you're on the show. They were 11th in points scored and 7th in yards gained in the NFL in a season where everyone was like, they're terrible, they suck, they can't do anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, there definitely is that element as well. I'm assuming your wide receivers are Will Fuller, DJ Moore, and Juju Smith-Schuster as the group that you are on the most?
I mean, Juju is certainly up there, no question. Who were the other ones you mentioned? Oh, Will Fuller. Yes, Will Fuller. Certainly very, very in on Will Fuller. A little less on DJ Moore. Not that I think there's anything wrong with him or bad at all. It's just I think he's probably fairly priced. So it's not as if I'm massively going out of my way to get DJ Moore, but it's not as if I would turn down DJ Moore either. One guy I am significantly higher on is Amari Cooper. And it has to do with that Cowboys offense. And certainly Cooper is volatile, but I think that Cowboys offense is going to be great. Cooper, people are poo-pooing a guy who's had 4,000-yard seasons in 5 years. Like, what do people want? And if this offense really takes off, I think Cooper is going to be a pretty big part of it. I like that. I talked with Matt Harmon, and he said, you know, like, Cooper isn't a great route runner, and that's – I would say that's probably the case. But I still think that he's versatile enough to line up all over the field. And I could actually see him playing significant slots in the snap. Sorry, significant snaps in the slot. And if that happens, man, like I think he could have like a Juju type of performance in the middle of the field. So I don't know. Like Cooper, I'm not saying, oh, he's a lock for a top five fantasy finish at the position, but I think he has a pretty good chance of getting there.
So I think that's so clearly true. And I think the slot stuff is really underrated because, you know, we're all just kind of penciling in Blake Jarwin for this really good year. And I am drafting a ton of Blake Jarwin. I don't think he's priced anywhere near his ceiling. I think it's so fair where he's being drafted. But Blake Jarwin might just be the most just a guy of all time. And Dallas historically has liked to use their tight ends out of that slot formation, you know, and the backup tight end situation is such in Dallas that we expect 11 personnel to be their base set where they go, you know, Lamb, Cooper, Gallup on, I don't know, 75 to 80% of their total snaps. And if Jarwin is just a guy, as his prospect profile seems to indicate, though he's been hyper efficient at the NFL level, it probably tactically makes most sense for Cooper to play out of the slot because Gallup is a really good boundary wide receiver and Lamb is also, you know,
so is Lamb.
Lamb was a total boundary wide receiver at Oklahoma. So the thing that would make most sense for Dallas to do is to use Cooper there. And that probably raises Cooper's target floor from 120 to 135 with up to like 180 targets as being reasonable if Dallas gets in a ton of competitive games where they have to throw that much. And Cooper would just, I mean, that would be an insane nuclear season.
Yeah, that's and that's what I'm thinking. You know, like it makes much more sense to have Cooper in the slot than to have Lamb there. Like Lamb wasn't bad in the slot in college. He was pretty good there, but he just didn't play there all that often. But like Cooper has the ability to play in the slot, and I think he could do that really well. So it's not as if it's like really sexy to be like, oh, Amari Cooper, because he's still like going in the top 15, but like I don't think he's going anywhere close to where he's
but like I wouldn't take Julio Jones over Amari Cooper ever.
Well, I mean, I'm also really high on Julio this year, but
I mean, try and sell me on it. I don't like Julio is just going to have the Julio year, but then you just every year a guy gets over the age of 30, you got to bake in more risk that he is not as good anymore.
What do you think is a realistic over under for the number of yards Julio gets this year?
Well, let me go see what I have projected so I don't say anything really stupid. My first gut intuition of over-under is like 1,200. 1,200 yards. And I have him projected for 1,300 receiving yards. So that bakes in a little bit of injury rest that my projections don't.
1,200, I think, is a really bad number considering that he's never had fewer than like 1,390 in the last like 5 or 6 years. You know, like I think Julio, if you go to DK Sportsbook, probably has, if it's not the highest yardage over under, the second right behind Michael Thomas. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Like I actually have Julio projected for more yards this year than Michael Thomas. And like that is probably ridiculous, but if you just sort of look at what Julio's done over the past 5-6 years, that stacks up right up there with what Michael Thomas has done for the past 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, I that was no shade intended for Julio Jones, but I'll just pretty much always draft the 26-year-old over the 31-year-old. Just
that's fair.
There is with wide receivers though, there is always this really interesting thing of like survivorship bias where like all of these guys begin to crater off at 29 and 30. So that influences the sim scores. But if you survive that age 30 barrier, because the guys who have played past that have been so great. So, you know, we're talking Larry Fitzgerald, Andre Johnson, Randy Moss had good seasons past the age of 30. What's interesting is when you start running sim scores for guys past the age of 30 and 31, you're like, oh, these are our stone cold Hall of Famers and then guys who had to retire, right? So it's like, right. It's like Marvin Harrison and TJ Houshmandzadeh. It's like there's no scenario where the 31-year-old guy has a wide receiver 2 season. It's either like, oh, he continues to be a Hall of Famer or I can't start him, which will change as modern medicine changes and guys are able to play longer and longer, especially at wide receiver. But right now, it is just very funny when you go try and look at what 31-year-old players do.
But big picture, you were making the comparison of Amari to Julio. I'm in on both of those guys, but Amari, it was more of a pro Amari statement. Like I'm really in on Amari this year.
I am really good. What about, do you have a favorite of the Font, Gesicki, Hockenson, Jarwin, like that kind of round 10, well, in FFPC, like 9 through 11, tight ends?
Yeah, it's Fant. Pretty handily.
And that's not, me too.
That's nothing against Hockenson, who I think has great long-term potential, but he has, I think, many more target competitors, in Detroit. And you know, Gesicki has a lot of potential, but that offense could still be really bad in Miami. But there are two things with Fant. One, just like the natural ability. And then secondly, like, I think that offense, I don't want to say like Pat Shurmur is like, a guy who just comes in and absolutely fixes all of the problems in that offense. But I think that offense could actually be better than people are expecting. And I don't know if we should automatically assume that Jerry Jeudy and KJ Hamler come in and get a lot of targets. The same with Melvin Gordon. who I still think will get decent targets, but like, I don't think he's going to have like a 15% target share. So there are a number of targets that are going to be available for Fant, and his rookie season looks fairly comparable to George Kittle. And he has Kittle-esque athleticism. Not that he is
more touchdowns, by the way, than George Kittle. I did like this last week, I did my my guys, right? The guys who I'm trying to hammer as much as possible. And I dug up that in NFL history, right? So I like to do these on Pro Football Reference every once in a while where you don't specify a time. So you can go back to like 1932. So of all time, tight ends to be drafted. Actually, I didn't even run a draft filter. So just 500 yards, 5 touchdowns, 11 tight ends in NFL history. Two of them as rookies, two of them were Gronk and Hernandez, right? Yes. Which always come up every time you run. Randomly Dwayne Allen, because he played with Peyton Manning as a rookie, so he just got lucky. Jeremy Shockey, it never ended up being a Hall of Famer, but posted multiple tight end one seasons.
Mike Ditka back in the day, I'm imagining. Yeah.
Mike Ditka. Another guy who I'd never heard of who made the Hall of Fame, like some like 1960s Green Bay Packers tight end. Literally no idea. A couple other guys in the 60s. And then Tony McGee, who played with the Bengals in the 90s. I have no idea who he is, but he happened to do it. And then posted multiple tight end one seasons in the future. But basically the calculus was these are all players who played in the NFL for like 10 plus years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Fant has a ton of potential. And, besides Hockenson's final season at Iowa, like before that, Fant was the guy, you know. And even when Hockenson broke out in his final season, Fant still had pretty decent production. So there's, kind of long term reasons to be interested in Fant.
I mean, what about the biggest long term result being Hockenson is going to be asked to be a blocker for his entire NFL career, and Fant's team will never ask him to do it because he's not any good at it.
That would be so tilting to everyone who loves Hockenson. I think he could still be awesome, but that's within the range of outcomes.
That was the biggest part of his scouting report. Like all the reason why all the NFL guys were like, oh, Hockenson's going to go ahead of Fant. Remember, you and I bet.
Yes.
I bet you that Fant would go ahead of Hockenson.
Yeah.
Because I saw the same thing that you're seeing now, which is like, oh, this guy's just Jimmy Graham, but fast. Like Jimmy Graham was never fast, but Fant is actually really fast.
Yeah.
And, but the NFL guys are just like, oh, Hockenson's like having a third tackle out there. Our boy Thor Nystrom from Roto World is like the biggest TJ Hockenson guy ever. And that was the thing he would always say. And that's what NFL coaches see. That's what the Lions GM saw. Like they just love how, and that's Hockenson will probably play more snaps every year than Fant, but Fant will run more routes.
Yeah. I think that's fair. I mean, and Kittle really is sort of like that perfect blend of Fant and Hockenson, because he can block the way that people want Hockenson to do it, but he still has that sheer athleticism that Fant has, which is just like uber elite for the position.
Yeah, no doubt about. Are you like a semi believer in this Denver air raid where like they look at what Kansas City's doing and they draft all those guys and they're like, yeah, we're gonna run out KJ Hamler and Albert O, and we're gonna try and throw it 35 times a game?
Yeah, it's hard to know what I mean, because Drew Lock obviously is not Patrick Mahomes, but I mean he's got that gunslinger mentality, and they do have weapons there. And I'm really optimistic about Courtland Sutton this year, in part just because I don't know how many targets the other guys are going to get. I do think that Denver offense is going to be better than people expect, and I have a lot of respect for Courtland Sutton. So I think he does something pretty similar this year to what he did last year, which means that I'm higher on him than a lot of people are. But Denver in general, I think they could be pretty good. Albert O is a little bit harder to know what to make of, because if you just look at guys who have his athletic measurables, like a high number of those guys crush, even if you look just at the guys who were taken in the third, fourth, and fifth rounds, like you're comparing him to guys like Jimmy Graham. So long-term, I am interested in Okwuegbunam. It's just hard to know like how to stash him in Dynasty, because it's like, do you really want to, I don't want to say you're wasting a roster spot on him, but you're investing a roster spot in him knowing that it's very unlikely he's going to do anything for 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, he is a guy that you would really like to have in your 30-man best ball super flex dynasty, tight end premium rosters. Right. You'd really like to have him a lot less in the FFPC format where you cut down your roster to 14 guys every year and the rookie draft is 8 rounds and you end up taking a bunch of vets. Like, you're just you'd probably rather take him with your 7th round rookie pick next year than hold him on your roster through this entire season.
Exactly. He's deep dynasty only, but that said, he is super intriguing to me in that format.
Yeah. All right. Well, there we go. That's a big conversation. We all got there. Yeah. How are you feeling? Are you getting pumped? When are you and Dave doing your main event?
Probably like a week before the season starts. So, getting excited for it, you know, just, managing, projections, doing little tweaks every day, you know, thinking about articles I might have the time to write, although who knows if that actually ends up happening, but, right. Getting excited, continue to be probably too optimistic that we have a season, but you know, I've maintained for months that we will have a season. It's just always been the question of, you know, do we start on time? Is there a work stoppage in the middle of the season? Do we play a full 16 games? Does the quality of the game suffer either because there isn't, you know, the normal training camp or because a lot of players are out? But continue to be very optimistic that we have a season.
Yeah, I am optimistic as well. Everyone, make sure to listen to Matt on RotoViz Radio. Make sure to read his stuff over at the Action Network and Fantasy Labs. I'm sure Matt will be back on, again before the season, probably during the season as well. And go out there and get yourself some Antonio Gibson. We'll be back later this week.